Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at and that illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that will determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you of the views expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, and for the next hour, the views of William Grigg, former senior editor of the New American Magazine, and certainly now he has his own blog, he has his own radio program, but he writes the Radio Liberty newsletter because I just need the time for other things, and besides that, he does such a great job, but right now, he's going to be with us for the next hour, and William, what are we going to be talking about?
Dr. Stan, as always, it's a real pleasure and privilege to be with you, and I really appreciate your kind words. Of course, we're nearing Independence Day, which is an increasingly bittersweet holiday for those of us who understand and cherish the principles on which the American Republic was founded. And as we see the accelerating and deepening economic decline and the unraveling of the current political system, it's a good idea to go back, perhaps review the founding principles of the Republic, or actually the founding principles, if you will, of the rebellion that led to the creation of the Republic. And there's two elements of the letter that the rebels sent to King George that, of course, was primarily written by Thomas Jefferson, upon which I want to focus just briefly. The first is a statement that's almost never mentioned in the Declaration of Independence. These stately cadences about life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness are well known and, unfortunately, largely misunderstood. But there's a coefficient to that claim of God-given rights and the necessity to protect those rights that is usually ignored. Certainly it's not taught in most government schools today. And that phrase is the following: whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, that is, the protection of life, liberty, property, the pursuit of happiness, it is the right of the people to alter or abolish it and to institute new government, laying its foundation on such principles and organizing its powers in such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness. Safety in this instance, of course, refers to protection against the abuse of power that undermines individual rights. Most people assume that when we talk about safety, we're talking about some kind of a paternalistic government that has as its mandate protecting us from the vicissitudes of life, making life as idiot-proof as possible, protecting us from the frustrations and challenges attendant to different and equal means of acquiring property, as James Madison pointed out, to use this phrase from the Federalist Papers. That's not what the Founding Fathers were talking about. They certainly weren't talking about a government that would be a cradle-to-grave proposition that would encompass us in the supposedly loving arms of collectivism and embrace the life out of us, suffocating our liberty in the crib. They were talking about safety from government depredations. And some of those depredations, of course, are listed in the Bill of Particulars. And in that Bill of Particulars, I want to focus on the following elements of the complaint against the Crown.
Now, you're speaking, of course, of the Declaration of Independence.
Declaration of Independence, yes. He, that is to say, King George, has erected a multitude of new offices and sent hither swarms of officers to harass our people and eat out our substance. He has kept among us in times of peace standing armies without the consent of our legislatures. He is affected to render the military independent of and superior to the civil power. Those three elements are something I want to focus on a little bit, because we're really looking at a situation now in late Imperial America where those conditions exist to an extent the Founding Fathers could not have imagined, an extent far worse than they confronted when they declared their independence from the British Crown.
In fact, of course, we saw the use of militarized troops there in New Orleans,
under
Katrina. Of course, they brought in their professional mercenary killer, from Blackwater, to patrol the streets of America. Why would you do that? Why wouldn't you use the National Guard? Oh, they were over in Iraq defending America, or were they simply pushing imperialism? William, you go right ahead.
Dr. Stan, you're probably referring to the most recent disclosures by Ray Nagin about his encounter with these unnamed and apparently unidentified mercenaries, security operatives, who were wearing tactical vests and were accoutred with every manner of firearm and instrument of mayhem that can be attached to a person who showed up and simply started acting as if they owned the place. And Mayor Nagin has said on a couple of occasions that he was afraid that he might end up on the receiving end of some kind of lethal strike from somebody associated with a three-letter agency during the Hurricane Katrina tumult, the post-Katrina uprising. Well, it wasn't so much an uprising as just a collapse, a meltdown. And one of the things that we also saw, in addition to the arrival of American troops to police the area affected by the flood and the dam break, was the completely unfettered corruption of the nominally local police department, where you had the incident there on the bridge in which people who were identified incorrectly as looters who were actually refugees were simply summarily gunned down. There was a journalist present, a photographer present, embedded with the police officers who aided this cover-up. There's, of course, a trial going on right now in New Orleans about this incident at the bridge. But this is sort of a cross-section of the way the system works. Once again, as you pointed out, Dr. Stan, this is an imperialist system, meaning it's one in which you do not have, in any tangible way, Republican institutions and Republican principles, small-r Republican principles, restraining the power of the government. You had, of course, the National Guard troops overseas in Iraq. Much of the equipment that would have been used to deal with the aftermath of the hurricane and what happened, of course, with the levees being overwhelmed, couldn't be operated by people who were there. The people who were necessary to act as so-called first responders were out of country, and you have this huge diversion of funding and materiel. Those are imperial priorities. So you have the situation where the personnel and resources are sucked outside the United States, leaving a vacuum that's filled with what? It's filled, first of all, with mercenaries operating through a public-private partnership. That's what Blackwater is, not a private entity. It's a fascist entity. It's one that has a private corporate presiding body, but it's one that receives its commission from and its funding from the government and is immune, really, in a way that most corporations aren't immune, or most private institutions aren't immune because of that relationship with government. They were the first to fill the vacuum. And then, of course, you had eventually U.S. troops who went in to fill the vacuum. And that, of course, is what happens in an imperial situation.
Hold that thought. Hold that thought. We're going to be back here in just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Of course, William is talking about the misuse of the military in the United States. And he's actually talking a little bit about a new book. I haven't had a chance to read it yet, although I've ordered it. It's written by the mayor of New Orleans. His name is Nagin. He got sort of a bad press, and I don't know whether it's justified or not. But he tells the story of what happened and the total breakdown of society. And, of course, bringing in the professional murderers, mercenaries from Blackwater. Why would you bring these people into this area? Why is it they did this whole thing come about, actually? The storm did not hit New Orleans, basically. What happened was that the levees gave way. A number of the people in New Orleans claimed they were explosions. They heard the explosions. This is not just one person. A number of them claimed that there were explosions there. Somebody blew out the levees. And, of course, you might say, well, that sounds a little paranoid. But then, of course, as you look and see as this whole story played out, one of the things that really disturbed me was the fact that they took so many of the people there, poor, predominantly black, and they put them in prefabbed homes or trailers, I've forgotten which one it was, and they all reeked of formaldehyde.
Mm-hmm.
Now, why would you have these home trailers and all would reek of formaldehyde? Because formaldehyde leads to cancer. And it wasn't just a little odor there. I mean, it lasted for months than they were in them. The formaldehyde was seeping out of the walls. Why would you build trailers for indigents or for people being evacuated from a major catastrophe that reeked with formaldehyde? I mean, was this an accident, knowing full well this is a carcinogen? Or was this done intentionally? If we're talking about thousands of them, how could the government mistakenly buy thousands of trailers that reek of formaldehyde, knowing full well it's a carcinogen. It's just recently been declared as such. Is this simply shows total ineptitude of government? Or are there really people in government who would like to poison some of the predominantly black part of the population? These questions, really, nobody really wants to ask. But certainly, I believe that Nagin's book should be read and widely. We hope to get him and get him onto our program. Have you had a chance to read it yet, William?
I haven't yet, but that also is in my list of books that I want to get this coming month for the same reasons that you described, Dr. Stan. And when you're dealing with the circumstances that you just alluded to and the developments that you discuss, the possible explanations start with culpable indifference or criminal stupidity and then get worse.
It could be criminal intent, not criminal stupidity.
Thing. I mean, we start with something that has to be considered, at the very least, criminal negligence, and then things move in a direction that leads us into more ominous territory.
But, you know, the stories we heard at that time were certainly people from all over the area there wanted to come to help, and people wanted to come and they wanted to bring food and supplies. I mean, there were people stranded on the tops of buildings. There were people stranded in the hospital. People stranded everywhere. And there were all sorts of flotillities of people with motorized boats who wanted to come in and help. And they were prevented from helping by armed forces, which were there to keep people from coming in to offer aid and food and help and medical supplies. And you have to ask, how could they be so inept unintentionally? Go right ahead.
Well, that's, of course, one of the few things that government is renowned for is focused ineptitude. But stupidity and ineptitude can only explain so much. And certainly one element of the story that sort of provides the prologue to this whole catastrophe is the fact that those levies were maintained by what agency of which government. They weren't maintained locally. They weren't constructed locally. They were constructed by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. And you've got a similar situation, of course, with the flooding going on in the Midwest right now, where you have all these structures that were put up by the military that are failing. I come from southeastern Idaho. If memory serves, the Teton Dam, which was essentially a huge berm with a great big pile of dirt, it failed in, I believe, 1977. It had been constructed by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, and it failed, and you ended up with most of southeastern Idaho from, I believe, Driggs all the way down to Idaho Falls almost, that was completely submerged and wiped out. And you had hundreds of millions of dollars, we're talking 1978, $79 dollars, in property damage. And many of the things that go into these catastrophes have to do with the fact that you have an agency, the federal government, that does not have a constitutional warrant to be involved in any of this infrastructure building, maintaining this infrastructure, maintaining it poorly. And then you have FEMA, the same people who inflicted these formaldehyde death trailers on the refugees from Katrina and the flooding. FEMA, through its flood insurance program, creating perverse incentives for people to build on floodplains where they most likely wouldn't locate if they had to go out in the open market and buy insurance that would be commensurate with the risk that something that happened in 1993 when they had the floods in the Midwest that made headlines. Many of the people who were wiped out by those floods had been receiving, on almost concessionary terms because it's subsidized by the taxpayers, this FEMA-issued flood insurance. And this, of course, has the effect of attracting people to build their residential and commercial properties in a place where they're almost certainly going to be wiped out by a flood. And so they're encouraged to build there, and then you have the U.S. government military creating the infrastructure, maintaining the infrastructure in ways that are completely unsuitable, and the result, of course, is catastrophe, and with catastrophe comes opportunity. And with opportunity, of course, you have the arrival of these armored mercenaries who are proprietaries of the federal government. They're not three-letter agencies, but they might as well be. They're certainly used as day players by some of the three-letter agencies. And then you have the corrupt elements in federalized law enforcement bodies living down to their impulses, their lowest impulses. And then eventually you have the military move in. And as a result, you have the complete destruction of civil society and the enthronement of an order that is raw undisguised naked imperial force. And that, of course, in my opinion, is a foreshadowing of what we're likely to see as we witness the accelerating unraveling of this debt-based system that is taking place here in the United States, but is more forcefully being seen overseas. A lot of people have talked about what's happening in Greece right now as a foreshadowing for what's likely to happen in the United States. That, of course, in my opinion, is an entirely defensible assessment, just as what had happened over a decade ago in Argentina could be seen as prologue to coming ugliness here in the United States. And you've got street clashes between mobs in Greece that are organized by government unions and by hardcore street-level Marxist activists. We have those same elements in play here in the United States. One of the very useful things, tragically useful, unfortunately, but very instructive things we see as our own premonitory rumblings of large-scale social upheaval grow more intense is the extent to which government has become a unionized exercise, and how people who are supposedly our protectors, and not merely, of course, in police agencies, but also in fire departments and in other so-called protective first responder entities, how their first loyalty really is to their fellows in government unions who are protecting their pay, perks, and pensions at the expense of those of us in the protective class who have to subsidize them through our taxes. And so we really have a recreation in a much larger scope and scale of the circumstances described here, once again, in the Declaration of Independence, where it talked about King George erecting a multitude of new offices, and sent hither swarms of officers to harass our people and eat out their substance. Honestly, compared to what's going on today, what was happening in pre-revolutionary America would be seen as a very modest and unobtrusive government. We really have a much higher tax burden. There's a far greater level of established impunity on the part of people who exercise coercion on behalf of government. And, of course, within the bureaucracy as well, these people are almost entirely insulated from accountability of any kind. That's one of the reasons, this assumption that they are above us, that they are untouchable, that we are clay to be molded to suit their whims and interests. That's one of the reasons why you're seeing this increasing trend of bureaucrats in county commissions and municipal governments and other bodies of that sort using their influence with the local police to punish people who are trying to take photographs and make records and report on what's going on in these municipal bodies, these municipal government bodies and county government bodies. There was this incident just a couple of weeks ago in Washington, D.C., involving what should be considered a very minor and peripheral bureaucracy having to do with licensing and inspecting cabs. And there was a public meeting, it was open to the public and available to all, where the licensing and inspection board for the cab bureaucracy in Washington, D.C., ordered the people in charge of this meeting, ordered the police to arrest and expel reporters who were reporting on an open meeting. And you had these very young journalists, one of whom was frog marched out of the building in handcuffs because he was trying to make a record of this public meeting. And then later on, when an effort was made to follow up by sending a reporter to the headquarters of this bureaucracy, the reporter was not allowed in, and then the door was locked and the lights were turned out so that there could be no accountability. There's another incident down in, I believe, Miami just a couple of days ago where a reporter was marched out of the room by a police officer because, in spite of the fact that this reporter was a credentialed journalist with a local recognized news agency, she wasn't permitted to take photos and actually make notes of what was going on in this meeting. This is a sense of impunity. They want to treat accountability as if it's somehow an imposition on their rights when they're supposed to be servants. They're supposed to be doing our bidding and working on our behalf rather than acting as these officers described in the Declaration of Independence.
Well, I think increasingly we are going to see less and less of freedom in this country. I think this is why it's so important we go back and we read the Declaration of Independence. We understand the background of the formation of this country, and we proclaim we are Americans and we will not be intimidated into giving up our freedom. We'll be back in just a moment with William Greig. William, you go right ahead.
Adverting once again to what happened in New Orleans after Katrina, I don't remember, Dr. Stan, if I've ever made mention to you of the story of Abdul Rahman Zaitoun. He was a Syrian-born American citizen who was arrested and held in a FEMA camp in New Orleans immediately after the flood. He was living in his house. He was somebody who owned commercial property in New Orleans, and he was trying to take care of the people in his neighborhood. They were on elevated property, which meant that the floodwaters didn't reach them for quite some time. He'd sent his wife and children to stay with relatives in Houston when the storm came in. And this, of course, is an established routine. When they have hurricanes coming in New Orleans, there are people who have evacuation routes and plans. They'll often make arrangements for most of the family to go to a relatively safe area where somebody stays there to watch the property, watch whatever businesses that they are taking care of. That's what Mr. Zaitoun did. He was well-known in the community. He's somebody who had a very good, well-established reputation. He'd been here for a number of decades, a law-abiding, hard-working person from a well-established and well-regarded family. He was in his home with a couple of other people who were refugees when a group of people barged in. There were National Guardsmen. There were people who were there who'd been in Iraq and sent back in order to provide security in this vacuum that we're talking about. And he was arrested and hauled away, as it happens, in a speedboat. This guy had been tooling around the flooded streets of New Orleans in his canoe, just checking on people, taking food and water to people while waiting for rescuers to arrive, and helping in the rescue of people who were stranded in their homes as the floodwaters advanced. He ended up being taken to a makeshift FEMA camp that was erected in the local Greyhound station. And while he was there, he was treated as if he were in Guantanamo. As a matter of fact, in terms of the architecture of the camp, the way that it was situated, the style of barbed wire in a bare enclosure surrounded by barbed wire, and the type of harassment and abuse that people were forced to suffer, it was a near model, near replica of Guantanamo. This is something that was created basically out of scratch within a couple of days by FEMA. It was owned and operated by FEMA. So when people talk about the idea of FEMA camps being something that's the artifact of a deranged mind, we actually have a case study here, a case study in which you had American citizens, not just Mr. Zaitoun, but others who were held in the FEMA camp, and eventually they were going to be taken off to prison. He was a specially designated prisoner because of his Syrian ancestry. He had no criminal record. There was nothing about this man, his background or his activities, that would denote that he was in any way a menace to the public good or a criminal of any kind. But he was taken to this holding facility, and he developed an infection and some fairly severe health problems. And then he was taken to prison, and he most likely would have remained in prison as a specially designated suspect, held under a protocol in which he had no recourse of any kind to the court. Bear in mind, at the time this is going on, the courts were shut down. He wasn't allowed to call anybody. He was finally able to call his wife because he had a chance encounter with a preacher who was delivering literature in the prison that he was taken to. He was taken from the FEMA camp to a regular
prison. Hold that thought. We'll be back in a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan. He's telling us a story about a Syrian man who was in New Orleans. He was a responsible landowner. He's sent his wife and family out of the city when they heard the storm was coming. They wanted to be safe. He was there, of course, helping to rescue people and providing food and water for people. He was in an area where he was on dry land. He wasn't certainly a menace to anybody. And then a group of people came in, whether they were from FEMA or whether they were from Office of Homeland Security and National. I think they were probably American troops who came in and arrested him and took him to a FEMA camp. And they had FEMA camps there with the barbed wire. And then he was hauled away to a prison. Now, what was his crime? No crime. No charges against him.
Nope.
No opportunity to communicate with anybody. And, of course, he was going to be treated as a prisoner. What was his crime? He was simply there in New Orleans after the storm, helping out. And so, basically, of course, the minister did come through. He was able then. Will you tell the rest of the story, William?
Yeah, he was held in this facility that was described in a book called Zeitun. It was just a very compulsively readable overview of this man's experience. And he was a Syrian American. He was an American citizen, a naturalized citizen from Syria. And this book described Camp Greyhound as being once again a replica of Guantanamo Bay. And the book, which is written by a novelist whose last name is Eggers, describes how at random people at Camp Greyhound were subject to summary abuse just because it was something that provided a distraction for the guards. This is how he recounts what happened. Always the procedure was the same. A prisoner would be removed from his cage and dragged to the ground nearby in full view of the rest of the prisoners. His hands and feet would be tied, and then sometimes, with the guard's knee on his back, he would be sprayed directly in the face with pepper spray. If the prisoner protested, the knee would dig deeper into his back. The spraying would continue until his spirit was broken. Then he would be doused with a bucket and returned to his cage. And, of course, once he'd been doused, they were exposed to the elements. Even, of course, in late August, September, it can get cold. And when you're sitting out there shivering and you're experiencing the extremes of heat and cold and being not being permitted to attend to basic physical hygiene necessities, you're going to get sick. And so for a couple of weeks, Mr. Zeitun and his friends were taken to the, I believe it's pronounced, Elian Hunt Correctional Center, which was a regular prison. And for more than 2 weeks after they were taken to this prison, they were abused, neglected, humiliated, and subjected to regular visits from a extreme repression force. That's what it's called, ERP, extreme repression force. Once again, this is something that they have in Guantanamo. This is a specially designated group of guards who are clad in black riot gear. They usually have ballistic shields, batons, pepper spray, sometimes tasers. And on one instance, the ERP, and I'm once again reading from this book, burst in as if Zeitun were in the process of committing a murder. Cursing at him, three men used their shields to push him to the wall. As they pressed his face against the cinder block, they cuffed his arms and shackled his legs. And then they began to strip search him and then tear his cell apart as if they were looking for something. Of course, he had nothing. He had been held at Camp Greyhound before being sent.
So this is in America. And this following Katrina, and this was justified because, oh my goodness, there's a crisis there. So we've got to bring in these thugs. And they can find criminal elements. Perhaps they're ex-prisoners. Perhaps they're just sadists. We have sadists in this country. And they very often will be employed by government to terrorize people. And where is the call for anybody being held accountable? There is none. Why don't we hear this on 60 Minutes? Because they don't want to hear about it. Because they control your reality. But this is the sort of thing that lies ahead for many people in the listening audience. If we don't take a stand and hold people accountable, and the people who commit acts of crime and criminal activity in government should be sent to prison and exposed to exactly the same sort of thing. But nobody's calling for it because everybody in Congress is afraid that similar things will happen to them and their family if they dare to speak out. Go right ahead.
That's true. And there's also a lot of money to be made in the prison industrial complex, if you will. One of the really dirty secrets here is that this is a huge and thriving industry. As a matter of fact, it's one of the few parts of the economy that's doing well right now. It's a booming business, putting people in cages, including, of course, people who are perfectly innocent. That's why we have the largest prison population in recorded human history here in the supposed land of the free.
One in every 100 American adults is in prison. One in every 3 American adults, 33 American adults is in prison, probation or parole. A far larger percent than exists in communist China. If that's true, why don't you hear about it? One in 33 young black men, 21 to 31, prison, probation, parole. Well, wait a minute. You go right ahead with the story. So what happened?
Well, there are a couple of other points of the story that need to be fleshed out, one of which is what happened just before Zaytun was sent, along with two of his friends. Well, actually, not two of his friends, two people that just met to St. Gabriel, the prison there, the regularly constituted prison in Louisiana. The first was that within a few hours of being sent to Camp FEMA, a fourth person was put in this enclosure with them. They were in a barbed wire enclosure, open to the elements. They had a black asphalt floor to sleep on. They couldn't sleep. They couldn't stand. They couldn't lie down. And this individual who called himself Jerry was put in their midst and immediately began trying to bait and provoke them into saying things that could be construed as sympathetic with terrorism. This guy told some story about being swept up by the police and having some kind of criminal history involving narcotics or some such. But as I wrote in the essay that I published about this a couple of years ago, you didn't have to see potting soil between this guy's toes to recognize that he was a plant. He was put there as a provocateur. He was trying to get them to say something that could be used to charge them with terrorism so that they could be disappeared, never heard from again. Well, as it turns out, Zaytun didn't say anything because he's not political. He didn't have any particular animus toward anybody. He just wanted to be free so he could see his wife, Kathy, and his kids again. But instead, he was taken to St. Gabriel, to the prison. And if it hadn't been for what some people would call a chance encounter with a preacher, he most likely would have disappeared into the system and never been heard from again. He literally describes how, driven to abject despair by virtue of the fact that his wife didn't know where he was, as far as she was concerned, he had died in the flood. He prayed. He said, you know, God, send an angel to me. And not 2 hours later, this black preacher shows up and hands him a book. And Zaytun said, could you please call this number in Houston and tell my wife I'm alive? And so the preacher called his wife and said, hi, is this Mrs. Zaytun? Your husband's here. I'm in prison with him right now. He's alive. He just wanted me to let you know that he's alive. He's not killed. He's not dead. And she said, well, how can I contact him? And he said, I can't talk to you anymore. I just want to let you know he's alive because I don't want to get in trouble. If they knew I was contacting you, they'd probably put me behind bars. Well, she was able to find out where he was and how to get him out of prison. But the problem was he was charged with looting his own home. That, of course, is a cover charge just to keep him behind bars. And when she tried to contact the court to find out when his hearing was...
Hold that thought. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Of course, William Dyer has been telling the story about this Syrian-American citizen who is taken off to a ruthless prison where he is tortured and mishandled. And this is after Operation, Hurricane Katrina. He is charged with looting his own home. He's in his own home. When, of course, the military breaks in to his home and hauls him off to prison because he's looting his own home. He doesn't have a hearing. He doesn't have any rights. He is tortured for several weeks, and nobody knows where he is. So you tell the rest of the story, and then, of course, we want to get the information
right
out on how people can contact you. But what's the next part of the story?
Well, 10 days after he was able to get this message to Kathy, she was able to contact an attorney who was able to get him out of prison. And then she went back to New Orleans to find out where the pretrial hearing was going to take place, and the court official said, we can't tell you that. That's privileged information. And she said, how is that possibly privileged? I'm his wife. In other words, it's something I need to know because in legal terms they form one person, if you will. And they said it's not, and then the functionary repeated, it's private information. She said, it can't be private. It's a public court. And then they finally had the hearing, and he was given $75,000 bail. He was charged with looting his own home. Kathy happened to run into a CNN reporter and told the story of her husband and what the family had experienced, and they were able to put enough pressure on the court to grant bail and then to get the charge dismissed. And unfortunately, the three friends, the three associates, actually, that... had been refugees, fellow refugees, in Zaytun's home. He'd opened up his house to these people he'd never known before. They were imprisoned for up to 8 months before the charges were dropped. It's entirely possible if the charges hadn't been dropped against Zaytun, once again, he would still be in prison somewhere, most likely being shuttled around heavenly knows where in this global labyrinth of black sites and detention facilities.
And ladies and gentlemen, one in every 100 Americans today, 100 American adults is in prison, probation, and parole. One in 33 one in 100 is in prison, one in 33 is in prison, probation, and parole. If that is true, why do we hear about this on 60 Minutes on 2020? Because we have the largest prison system anywhere in the world, here in the land of the free and the home of the brave. Well, before we go on, William, I want you to go ahead and tell our listeners how they can get to your website, how they can hear your radio program, how they can get to your PayPal button and help you continue getting the truth out. And then, of course, they can read the Radio Liberty newsletter and get some of your ideas. And William's working on the latest letter for us. But go right ahead and get that information out, especially about your PayPal button.
I appreciate that, Dr. Stan. My blog is called Pro Libertate. It's spelled ProLibertate and can be found at freedominourtime.blogspot.com. freedominourtime.blogspot.com. Or people can go to a search engine and type in Pro Libertate and my last name, Grigg, and that should be the first return you'll see will be my blog, Pro Libertate. I try to update it two or three times a week. The essays tend to be fairly long, 2,500 words or so, a fairly common length. And so there's a little bit more involved in writing for my blog than you'd see in many other blog sites that are short commentaries on items of interest in the news. For those of your listeners who are on Facebook, I'm on Facebook as well, and I do most of my conventional blogging through my Facebook page, where I'll post items of interest and then comment on them briefly. My radio program is also called Pro Libertate. Pro Libertate Radio is on every Sunday afternoon from 4 o'clock to 6 o'clock Central Time. 4 o'clock to 6 o'clock Central Time every Sunday afternoon on the Liberty News Radio Network. That's libertynewsradio.com. And it's in a pre-recorded podcast format, which means that you can listen to it live by way of terrestrial radio. And if you go to libertynewsradio.com, there's a list of affiliates for those who want to listen to it by way of conventional radio. You can listen to it by way of live streaming on the website, or you can listen to it as a podcast or download the podcast or subscribe to it by way of iTunes. That's Pro Libertate Radio, 4 o'clock to 6 o'clock p.m. Central Time every Sunday afternoon. You mentioned as well, Dr. Stan, that at the bottom of every essay on my blog, there is a PayPal button for those who have access to a PayPal account and are interested in helping me and my family keep this enterprise going. I really do appreciate all the very generous help we've received, and I'm particularly indebted to you, Dr. Stan, for the fact that you've made it a priority to let people know about donating to my website so as to make it possible for me to provide for my family and to keep this a going concern. God bless you, Dr. Stan. God bless everybody who's been so generous to us. It's something that we'll always appreciate. We are very humbled by your interest and your help.
Well, I think that your information is so vitally important, and you have just an amazing capacity to express it. We're involved in a battle of ideas, and somebody who can express the ideas as well as you do, I think we all need to support. So I certainly learned from William, and I'm always amazed. I've read a book, and he's read three of them on that subject, and it's not simply a one-upsmanship. He is certainly one of the most brilliant of the people we have, who is leading this ideological battle for the survival of Christian civilization and the souls of men. So is there anything else to this story about this Syrian gentleman? He finally got out? Was there any recourse? Did he have any recourse after being brutalized and tortured?
Unfortunately, there is a lawsuit that's unfolding right now, but it is colliding against this portcullis of privilege on the one hand, and also he finds it difficult to obtain traction owing to the fact that a lot of the people who are involved in this are not locally accountable civic officials. The half dozen National Guard soldiers who arrested him in his home were, of course, from out of state. Some of them, I think several of them, are from New Mexico. Nobody knows the identity of more than a couple of them, so you cannot track them down and hold them personally accountable. And if you tried to, of course, there'd be a question of sovereign immunity involved, because these are people who'd be considered federal officials. and part of the military, and so the command authority, the command authority structure would dictate that you'd have to try to hold their the people up the chain of the command accountable. That's just not going to happen. He's got this lawsuit pending, but chances are, once again, he's not going to see any kind of remuneration for his suffering, and I don't think that any would be adequate, quite frankly. His wife, as a result of her experience, had what appeared to be an ischemic incident. She's now where she had been vigorous and vibrant and very bright and perspicuous. She looks and talks and sort of has the shambling gait of a stroke victim. And that's the sort of thing, of course, that happens when you're dealing with somebody who's confronting exceptional stress. And one can only imagine what she went through, first of all, thinking that her husband was dead, and then finding out that he was in prison, and then dealing with this Kafka-esque situation in which he found himself. She's suffering long-term ill effects because of this. And the kicker to the story for me, Dr. Stan, is the fact that after this guy was needlessly arrested in his own home for looting his own home, and they knew that it was his home. He provided proper identification. The documents were there. He was able to explain what was going on to the satisfaction of any reasonable person. After being hauled off to the camp, FEMA camp gulag at the Greyhound station, then hauled off to prison, being abused and becoming sick, his home was looted. Actual looters showed up and denuded that home of everything of value. So this really is, and we look at it, sort of the full combo plate of government-delivered ugliness. And this, I'm horrified to say, is quite likely, once again, sort of an augury of what we can look forward to as we're dealing with this unfolding combination of factors, the economic collapse, the ongoing and increasingly envenomed political conflicts here in the United States, the unfolding disaster of the municipal governments with their debt loads finally blowing up. All these things are happening at once. Add to that, of course, what's going on with flooding and drought simultaneously, and all kinds of upheavals that fall within the realm of the Creator's sovereignty over the planet, not man's self-inflicted injury. All these things are combining at once, and we're likely to see this sort of thing happen and be replicated on a grand scale. What happened in New Orleans, of course, is something that I consider to be sort of a preface to the unfolding of what we're going to be seeing on a larger canvas here in the United States. And one element of the story that not many people appreciate is the fact that in the context of the breakdown of civil order in New Orleans, the police turned into looters. You had National Guard soldiers confiscating firearms from American citizens who were trying to protect their property. You had police opening fire on refugees trying to flee to higher ground. And at the same time, as was captured on camera and broadcast on local news programs and on a couple of network news programs, you had police helping themselves to anything of interest and anything of value in any of the abandoned stores. So you really have, once again, the full canvas being unfolded there, a very limited canvas, you know, smaller than what we're seeing now. But if you want to see what America is likely to look like as our imperial decline accelerates, take a look at what happened in New Orleans. Now, by way of sort of qualified good news to remedy, or at least to take some of the bitterness away from that story, there is, once again, some highly qualified good news, out of Mississippi. I've made mention before on this program of the story of Corey May. He was a young father who was imprisoned in 2004 and sentenced to death for shooting and killing a deputy sheriff by the name of Ron Jones, who was part of a SWAT team that invaded Corey May's home on December 26, 2001. Corey May at the time was a 21-year-old father. He had a very small child. He was sleeping after pulling a very long shift at work when suddenly there were armed men at his home. He lived in a duplex. Corey May lived in a duplex with his family. On the basis of an anonymous tip, and how often do we hear that phrase in connection with stories like this, the SWAT team had been sent to this address in search of somebody they were told was a major drug dealer. Unfortunately, they got the wrong half of the duplex. Their warrant was for the other half of the duplex, not for the Corey May home. So all Corey May knew was that he was looking at a group of between 8 and 10 armed strangers in his house, and so he did something that most fathers in that circumstance would do when they have an 8 or 10-month-old baby sleeping next to them. He grabbed his gun and opened fire. and he shot and killed Ron Jones. And he said, as he was on the stand in his trial, that within a few seconds he realized that it shot a cop, so he dropped his gun and surrendered. There were still bullets in the gun. He didn't empty the clip. It turns out that Ron Jones was the son of the local police chief. Ron Jones Jr. was the son of the Prentice, Mississippi police chief, Ron Jones Jr. And on top of this, you have in Mississippi the overlay of the racial issue. Prentice, Mississippi, is a town, I think, about the same size as Payette, Idaho, where I live with my family here in southwestern Idaho. Corey May was black, Ron Jones was white, and that, of course, occasioned certain tensions and certain unfortunate historical resonances here when we're talking about Mississippi. So he was put on trial and then sentenced to death for first-degree murder, which means that somehow he was accused of the premeditated killing of somebody he didn't know was a police officer who had invaded his home in a no-knock drug raid on the basis of an anonymous tip. Well, this is something that became a matter of national controversy and international controversy because it was pretty clear that Corey May didn't intend to murder Ron Jones. It was pretty clear that he was acting out of the reflexive urgency of a father protecting his child from people who were in his home who didn't have any legal right to be there. That's the other part of this equation that has to be recognized. They had the moral and legal standing of a group of armed robbers committing a home invasion robbery because they were not at the right address. And that is one of the reasons, very good reason, very good illustration of the compelling urgency of ending this insane exercise called the war on drugs, because you create a situation in which you're going to have teams of armed paramilitary operators who are called police but are actually armies of occupation. Once again, what do we read in the Declaration of Independence on that subject? King George has kept among us in times of peace standing armies without the consent of our legislatures. It's essentially what's going on right now when they've converted the police into a standing army of occupation through the war on drugs, which is being fought like a war within the boundaries of our country. So Corey May was dealing with a split-second decision. Am I going to trust my life, the life of my infant child, to these people who are here who I don't know, or am I going to do what I can to defend myself? Now, under the controlling precedent, which is over 100 years old, the John Badelt decision of 1900, a police officer in that circumstance has no special standing before the law, and the terrible and tragic thing, of course, is that Ron Jones Jr. was killed. And as Corey May has pointed out, every single day he wakes up thinking about Ron Jones Jr. and his family, and every day he cries over this, because this is not something he intended to do. He was put into an impossible situation. And I'm sure that many people who have had the experience of pulling a trigger and ending a human life have the same kind of torment that Corey May was suffering. The biggest difference was that he was on death row until just a few years ago. Well, just this morning, a judge in Monticello, Mississippi, has signed a plea agreement with Corey May that ended his incarceration. He was sentenced to 10 years for manslaughter, retroactively. They changed, essentially, the definition of his crime to manslaughter and then gave him time served. So he is out of prison now after 10 years in prison. He shouldn't have been sent to prison because there was no mens rea. There was no criminal intent on his part, and the act itself was not innately criminal. But this, once again, illustrates how radically and drastically things have changed. 20 years ago, it was not commonplace. It was very rare for us to hear about this type of an incident in which a SWAT team raids the wrong address, you end up with somebody getting killed who should not have been killed.
And this is one reason, William, why we have to end the war on drugs.
Yeah.
Because this just the war on drugs justifies the SWAT team coming in with guns drawn and not simply presenting a warrant knocking on the door. And there is no way you can get around as long as you've got this war on drugs.
That's
if you can't keep the drugs out of the prisons, if you can't keep people in our prisons from getting drugs, why do you think that you can do this in general society without creating a police state? We've got to end the war on drugs, not because I believe in drugs. I don't. I've never used them. They're wrong. They're bad for people. But, of course, we're doing far more harm as far as the loss of our freedom because of this war on drugs. Go right ahead, William.
Well, one very important point here about what happened in the build-up to American independence. The swarms of officers referred to in the Declaration of Independence were enforcing anti-smuggling laws. They were cracking down on smuggling. They were conducting, if you will, the ancestor of the war on drugs. And that's one of the proximate causes of the American War of Independence. Now we're dealing with exactly the same situation. It's just immeasurably worse now than it was in the years before American independence.
Well put. We'll be back in just a moment with William to wrap up tonight's program. Ladies and gentlemen, you need to get a copy of this program. You need to listen to it several times. You need to understand the arguments, and then you need to get involved while there's still time. Well, William, we've got 3 minutes to wrap up the program.
Dr. Stan, once again, I want to tell you how much I appreciate everything you've done for our country. What a privilege it is to be speaking with you this evening on the near approach of the celebration of American independence. It's a bittersweet thing to reflect on the fact that the independence that was purchased at such a high and tragic price has been frittered away, and most people don't understand this. Most people assume that what we celebrate on the 4th of July is the majesty and might and glory of the government. That's why, of course, there's such a highly militaristic flavor to celebration of what we call the 4th of July rather than Independence Day. Properly understood, Independence Day is Insurrection Day. It's about the principled rebellion of people against a government that had usurped the authority of the sovereign people. It has started out as an effort by the American colonists to reclaim their ancient individual rights as Englishmen. And that's one of the reasons why statesmen such as Edmund Burke, and there were many other people of similar stature in England who sympathized with the American rebels, because they understood that it's impossible to be the subject of an empire that would oppress any of its subjects anywhere and preserve the freedom of those who lived in the homeland, if you will, of the empire. That was true in Great Britain in the 18th century. It's true of the United States today in 2011. We can't be an empire abroad and a republic at home. And we have, of course, undifferentiated imperial tyranny and corruption now. What had been a confederation, a constitutional confederation of free and independent states. And so if people would understand that the heritage we celebrate on the 4th of July is not the might and military prowess of the central government, but it's the principled insistence of individual patriots on protecting their God-given rights from the government that presumes to rule them. If we understand that and help other people understand it, we'll start to find headway, I think. We'll start to make headway in the effort to reclaim that which has been stolen from us.
And remember that liberty and limited government are synonymous. Tyranny and total government are synonymous. There are people who want tyranny. There are people who want to expand government control over every aspect of our lives. They are organized. They fit into what I call the Brotherhood of Darkness, the invisible government, the power elite. Doesn't matter what you call them. They've always been there. They were there at the time of King George. They're here today. William, thank you very much for being with us. And, of course, our guest has been William Grigg, and certainly one of my favorite times of the week is when William is with us at the end of the week. God bless you. Have a wonderful Independence Day.
God bless you, too. Thanks so much, Dr. Stan.
Good night. God bless. Okay, fine. That is William Grigg, and I hope you enjoy our weekly conversations with him. And he certainly is one of the outspoken spokesmen for liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan. This is the time when I need to remind all of our listeners that my ministry, Radio Liberty, is primarily listener-supported. And if you're out there in the listening audience, if you're in a position to help us, why, we hope you'll join the Radio Liberty family of supporters. And when you do, of course, you get our 4 best tapes or the CDs of the month. You get our monthly newsletter, which William Grigg is writing for us now. But more than that, you help us to support the now almost 65 outlets we have every single week as we reach out, certainly 5 hours every weekday and certainly on our weekend programs, to people across America with the news behind the news, the story behind the story. What if you'd like to join the Radio Liberty family of supporters? Our telephone number is 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. Our webpage is radioliberty.com. That's radioliberty.com. And certainly, if you have never heard some of the things that we have, if you haven't read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, you need to get it. We hope, of course, that you'll want to get Dr. Dennis Cuddy's four CD sets on the Illuminati. You'll get Barry Shamish's a set on the, it's entitled, the Return of the Giants. You'll get the DVD on the Watchers, and then you get the one on Watchers 2. Carol Matriciana has a wonderful, wonderful new DVD we're carrying called Broad is the Way. It goes into the background of the New AIDS influence in America. And, of course, Oprah Winfrey and Norman Vincent Peale, Robert Shuler, Rick Warren, and their effort to change the message and the music of our churches. And they've done a wonderful job. And you have to understand that there is a conspiracy against the God of the Bible. And so, basically, of course, we hope you go to our website, radioliberty.com. We hope that you want to get to Pastor Billy Crone's excellent material. Pastor Billy Crone's DVDs, we're on the final countdown, going into the prophecies. On certainly the fearful creation, going into the background of evolution. The judge creation, going into the background of the flood. They're all available by calling our 800 number. 1-800-544-8927. If you'd like to know about the programs we have here, you'd like to know what really happened to Martin Luther King, we have a 4-CD set on that. What really happened to Bobby Kennedy, we have a 4-CD set. We have a book and a DVD. You'd like to know what happened with the attack on the USS Liberty, we have a 4-CD set of the survivors of the attack on the Liberty. Men who lived, American servicemen, brave men, who lived in fear for 20 years because they were told they'd be killed or sent to prison for the rest of their lives if they ever dared in America to tell the truth. Well, we have a 4-CD set, we have a video that they put out, and a DVD that was put out by the BBC, of course, cannot be shown in America. In America, where we have freedom of the press, because, of course, that means the people who own the media have the freedom to suppress whatever they want. And they do suppress the story of the USS Liberty. We have, of course, four tape sets on the murder of Jack Kennedy. We have an excellent DVD by Bob Fletcher on President Kennedy. And he was murdered with the full help and support of people at the highest levels of our government, including the CDC, the CIA. If you want to know how they kill people, we have a 4-CD set called Deadly Assassins, where you hear Lieutenant Colonel Daniel Marvin tell about when he went to assassin school and was told by the CIA how they killed President Kennedy. Information you're not going to get elsewhere. Help us to get the information out by number 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. Please pray for Radio Liberty. Pray for our nation. And please pray for our leaders. And so until Monday at the same time, may the Lord be with you.